a much younger woman, one of the young mothers, with the hands in her white gloves clenched, and on her face an expression in which was mingled sadness and indignation. As the two women stood there, oblivious to everything but the trees falling in front of them, a dozen photographers snapped their picture. And the next day, those women were weeping on the front page of every newspaper in town, except the Herald Tribune, in which they were weeping on the split page, and the Times, which limited itself to views of the overall scene. As the Newmans had run out the door that morning with their 4-year-old son David, Arnold Newman had, at the last moment, turned back, snatched up the boy's toy rifle, and carried it to the park, where he had handed it to him. "We were in the business, you know," Augusta Newman explains, grinning. Other men in the business also knew a great prop when they saw one, and the next day, the little soldier in the park war was sitting pointing his gun, which seemed longer than he was, through the fence at the bulldozer, while, beside the small, pathetic figure, a burly policeman stood looking studiously away from him with genuine shame on his face, across 5 full columns of the front page of the Journal American. And these were only 2 pictures, 2 out of a dozen with drama and pathos. The News alone used 7 the next morning, 1 on page 1, 3 on page 3, 3 in the centerfold. Out at New York leapt scenes of a workman raising his axe next to a tree, while 3 big policemen restrained 1 diminutive mother stretching her hands out toward the tree as if to protect it from the blade, of mothers turning away from the line of policemen in tears, of little boys peering through the fence slats at the bulldozer rooting at a tree, while beside them a policeman stood sad-faced guard, of 1 dismembered tree, a sawn-through cross-section of its trunk very white in the picture, being loaded in sections onto a truck, of Stuart Constable striding past mothers and baby carriages with a self-satisfied little smirk on his face that, combined with the walrus mustache, made him look like nothing so much as the villain come to foreclose the mortgage in the old homestead, pictures worth not 1,000 words, but 1,000,000. And these pictures were flashed before the public not only in still life, but in motion, on evening television newscasts on which they were, if possible, even more dramatic. The outrage the press expressed was echoed by the public. Letters not by the hundreds, but by the thousands, poured into newspapers and the offices of public officials. On a single day, Mayor Wagner received close to 4,000. And if the public was outraged, they knew precisely whom they were outraged at. A single day's selection from a single newspaper shows the tone, in the Journal American of April 26th. "I have always admired Commissioner Moses, but he certainly pulled a boo-boo on that Central Park deal." Ex-Moses fan. "So the great Moses had to stoop to pulling a sneak attack at night to outmaneuver the battled Central Park mothers. What's the matter? Didn't he have the courage to face them in the daylight? Of all the low-down tricks, that's just about the lowest in my book." Mrs. C. Brown, Bronx. Those pictures of mothers weeping as they watched bulldozers tearing down beautiful trees and destroying a children's playground for, of all things, a parking lot for restaurant patrons, made me want to weep too. Shame on you, Commissioner Moses. Disgusted. Sneak, shame, ex-Moses fan. 30 years before, Robert Moses had leapt onto the front pages in a single bound, in stories that portrayed him as a fighter for parks, as a faithful, selfless public servant, a servant whose only interest lay in serving, as a hero. This portrait, painted in an instant, had survived for 30 years, and had hardened into an image that had withstood, without so much as a crack, a dozen explosions that would have shattered the image of the ordinary public figure. Now, in a single day, over a single dispute, a dispute over a hollow in the ground and a few trees, that image had cracked. Not wide open, of course. Large parts of it remained untouched. It was still an image untarnished by scandal, untainted by compromise. Robert Moses was still the public official uninterested in money, unwilling to truck with bureaucrats or truckle to politicians. But for the first time, he had been portrayed to the public at large not as a defender, but as a destroyer of parks, and as an official interested not in serving the people, but in imposing his wishes upon them. The image would never be whole again. Tuesday, April 24, 1956, the day that Robert Moses sent his troops into Central Park, was Robert Moses' Black Tuesday. For on it, he lost his most cherished asset, his reputation. The Moses boom had lasted for 30 years. Now, it was over. Surveying the battlefield on Tuesday night, Moses may have had at least one consolation. In one respect, at least, the Battle of Central Park appeared to have ended as his battles usually ended. However pyrrhic his victory, it was still victory. Press and public might yell, but the trees were coming down. His bulldozers were in operation, and no one in the city government was going to stop them, a fact that became clear on Thursday when Wagner's press secretary said, "Commissioner Moses has the right to do what he is doing. We have the right to stand behind the park commissioner." And the city council shunted a Stanley Isaacs resolution demanding action off to a committee which scheduled a hearing for the following week, by which time the trees would all be down and the grass would be covered with concrete. Moses declined the committee's invitation to attend. No councilman but Isaacs seemed to feel there was anything wrong with that. On the judicial front, there was a development on Thursday that may have been of interest to students of the law concerned with the influence of public opinion on the judicial process. In 1934, with Moses at the peak of his popularity and the voice of the press a chorus in his praise, the five justices of the appellate division had heard an appeal for an injunction in a case, Moses' move against Jimmy Walker's casino, turning on precisely the same basic question: the extent of Moses' authority over physical changes in Central Park, and had held, quickly and unanimously, that the authority was absolute. In 1956, with the voice of the press a chorus against him, State Supreme Court Justice Benjamin J. Hecht granted the mother's request for an injunction halting work pending a full hearing the next morning. Justice Samuel H. Hofstadter, who presided over this hearing, and who could hardly have been unfamiliar with the casino case, since as a state senator he had chaired the Seabury Committee that broke up the Walkerian Court, quoted poetry. "The tree depicts divinest plan. That is why I am taking cognizance of the trees," and paid a personal visit to the site, accompanied by 50 reporters, photographers, and TV cameramen. And when he completed the visit, he continued the temporary injunction pending a hearing on whether or not to make it permanent, a hearing that would be held before another judge. But Moses knew what the law said. He had, after all, written it. He was confident that this setback was only temporary and would soon be ended. He told Corporation Counsel Peter Campbell Brown that he wanted the hearing scheduled immediately. If by any chance he lost, he said, he wanted the case appealed at once. To a newsman who asked if there was any possibility of a compromise, he replied, "No, no, nothing of that sort." But even this consolation of victory was to be denied him. There were two points in the Tavern on the Green battle on which the commissioner was extremely vulnerable, and now Stanley Isaacs remembered one and discovered the other. One was the resemblance between this fight and the one over the casino. The mother's attorney, Lewis N. Field, probably at Isaac's suggestion, looked up the casino fight in the Times and found Moses' statements justifying his decision to tear down that old park landmark that only restaurants with reasonable prices within the reach of persons of average means belong in public parks. The fact that Moses had never believed this argument, that he had used it because it was the only one available, did not matter. What mattered was that he had used it, and his words could be quoted against him. And when Field pointed out that at the tavern a simple hamburger and a glass of beer would cost $4.50, the press took up his point eagerly, Soon, stories were informing the public about the tavern's alternating society orchestras, about the fashion shows attended by women in fur capes while several chauffeur-driven Cadillacs waited at the door, and about the non-economy prices that only well-to-do residents could afford. As one story put it, dinner and tip for two came to nearly $23. There was another $5 at the bar for two drinks each. It's not a place to go the day before payday. And the press coverage produced the fallout that could be expected. Soon, for example, the Reverend Dr. Ralph Curry Walker of the Madison Avenue Baptist Church was inveighing against the tavern in sermons and announcing that he would ask the Protestant Council of the Five Baptist Associations to adopt a resolution opposing the parking lot because it would tend to encourage the sale of intoxicating liquor in a park. The second issue, discovered by Isaacs, was the nature of the financial arrangement between Moses' park department and the restaurant's owner, old Moses' favorite, Arnold Schleifer. Schleifer paid the city only 5% of his gross income to operate a restaurant in the renovated sheepfold. This was a pittance compared to the rent most restaurant owners paid their landlords, even if Schleifer had paid at all. And, Isaacs discovered, he hadn't. Studying Schleifer's contract, the councilman found a provision that allowed the restaurateur to improve, repair, and renovate his restaurant and deduct the cost of the improvements from his rent payments. Checking with the comptroller's office, he found that the restaurateur had made full use of that provision. In 1 4-year period, for example, the gross income of the Tavern on the Green had been $1,786,000. On that income, Schleifer should have paid the city about $90,000, a low enough figure. Instead, he spent more than $80,000 on improvements. On a gross income of $1,786,000, he had paid the city only $9,000, half of 1%. Out of every $1,000 that he collected, he handed the city a lone $5 bill. Isaacs had heard rumors that Schleifer, who had been operating on a shoestring when he was first taken into the Moses Empire, was now a man of considerable wealth. After he saw those figures, the councilman had no trouble believing those rumors. Moses had made the concessionaire rich, and he had made him rich at the city's expense. The arrangement with Schleifer was a typical Moses arrangement, no different from scores in effect for more than 20 years with the favored concessionaires who were so integral a part of his empire. No different, in fact, from the others in effect with Schleifer, who, unknown to Isaacs, operated a half dozen other park concessions. There was nothing illegal about it. Moses certainly was not making a dime from it. He even insisted, to Schleifer's voluble dismay, on paying for every meal he ate there. He favored it partly because it allowed him to circumvent the city's budgetary requirements for capital improvements, and mainly because by giving the concessionaires huge profits, he was in a position to ask them to throw huge parties, the lavish dinners and receptions that were an integral part of his way of power. At many of his most elaborate receptions, receptions for guests in the hundreds or thousands, the Tavern on the Green had provided not only plates, glasses, silverware, tablecloths, napkins, and the finest of food and liquor, but waiters and busboys and bartenders and chefs. The Board of Estimate would never have approved the expenditure for such parties, of course. It would have felt the city had more pressing needs that might be met with the thousands, tens of thousands of dollars involved. But under this arrangement, the board had nothing to say about them. For more than 20 years, Moses had been boasting that he had ended all favoritism to concessionaires, and for more than 20 years, the press had been repeating and amplifying that boast and ignoring Isaac's attempts to present them with the facts that would have disproved it. But this time, when Isaacs talked, the press was listening, and when he provided facts on the Tavern on the Green concession arrangement, reporters gobbled them up. Suddenly, there were editorials in a tone that had never been used in relation to Moses before. At issue now is the park commissioner's latitude in dealing with concessionaires, the World Telegram said. The financial arrangements between the Tavern on the Green and the city coffers need a lot more explaining than anyone has been willing to provide so far. Park windfall. Tavern pays only one-third rent, headlines blared. Park Tavern yields city only 2%. Moses ducks council hearing. Moses drops curtain on Tavern Park deal. Windfall, ducks, deal. Words that spelled scandal. The editorials, headlines, and stories were oversimplified, so oversimplified as to be misleading. But whereas Moses had always used his image to make the press's bent for oversimplification work for him, now that bent was working against him. In the sense in which the public understood words like windfall and deal, illegalities, payoffs, bribes, there was no scandal in the Tavern on the Green affair. But the press made it appear that there was. During more than 30 years of public service, the name of Robert Moses had never even been brushed by so much as the hint of scandal. But the hint of scandal was brushing it now. He apparently did not realize at first the threat to his name and the controversy over the insignificant parking lot. He saw no need to change plans for a vacation. On the very morning on which Hofstadter issued his injunction, Moses was boarding the Italian luxury liner Cristoforo Colombo with Mary for a 24-day trip to Spain. Reporters rushing to the dock to get his reaction found him smiling and relaxed. "We're just going to go right through with the action," he said. "We will pursue this to the last court." And those had, in fact, been his private instructions to Corporation Counsel Peter Campbell Brown. But he realized it at last. His crossing was sunny, but behind him, the storm he had expected to blow itself out raged harder than ever. For the press was being given a continuing supply of fresh meat on which to feed. Constable, trying as usual to out Moses, refused outright to provide reporters with detailed figures on the tavern modernization program of which the parking lot was a part, a mistake that Moses would never have made. For not only were the figures public record, but they were available to the reporters in the city comptroller's office. Reporters demanded that Wagner order the park department executive officer to release them, and a flustered mayor did, telling his press secretary to deliver the order to Constable personally. The figures revealed nothing new, but the fact that the mayor had ordered them released made a front-page story in the Times. Mayor Wagner directed the park department yesterday to produce detailed figures. When they were produced, Wagner pointed out that there was nothing to hide. But the press didn't concentrate on that statement. Reporters had pressed the mayor as to whether the Board of Estimate would investigate the concession arrangement. Only after he had run out of evasions did he reply at all, and then he did so as circumspectly as possible. "I think we will discuss it. No doubt we will discuss it." But the press blew his words up into far more than they meant. A six-column headline across page one of the World Telegram blared, "Mayor demands airing of Park Tavern finance." Such press coverage, and the continuing public response, letters poured in and were printed by editors day after day, coupled possibly with Moses' absence, encouraged politicians to make statements on the issue. And each statement made another meal for the press. One can almost see, day by day, the realization dawning among reporters and headline writers that even though the public official involved was Robert Moses, this story could be handled like any other story. Day by day, their pens grew sharper. Appearing on WCBS-TV's Let's Find Out, Wagner was asked about the financial arrangement. "There is nothing illegal about it," the mayor said. Moses had clearly been acting within his powers under the city charter. He went out of his way to defend the park commissioner. "The controversy has been rather amusing," he said, "because he has been the toughest one, if you remember, about holding on to park space and trying to acquire more." When reporters pressed him as to the possibility of board action on the arrangement, he gave the minimal response possible. The board would review the possibility of requiring bidding on all city concession contracts. But what the headline said the next day was, "Moses' wings due for a clip," and Wagner and City weigh curb on Moses. Corporation Counsel Brown had asked Wagner if he should go ahead with the appeal of Hofstadter's decision as Moses had asked. Do whatever Moses wants, the mayor told him. And the ensuing appeal provided still more fresh meat, as well as fresh evidence of the interaction of public and judicial opinion. In 1934, when another corporation counsel had appealed the decision of a lower court judge, the five justices of the appellate division had agreed unanimously that while the powers that the law granted to Moses were far too broad, the law as it stood was perfectly clear. They had no choice but to overrule the lower court's decision. In all relevant respects, the law was the same, but this time the five justices unanimously upheld the lower court. When Brown argued that the restaurant was open to anyone, one of the justices said, "You mean anyone who can afford it? I'm not complaining about my salary, but I can't afford $5.85 steaks." "More than I pay," says Judge. The criticism began to spread from the one isolated tavern incident to the legend as a whole. "What I have not seen commented on," said one letter writer in the World Telegram, pointing out that in Van Cortlandt Park alone, more than 150 acres had been devoted to traffic use, "is the general policy of the commissioner. He seems to feel that as long as money can be saved by the use of park property instead of condemning private land, any invasion of the parks is justified." Federal officials, long silent, released statements critical of the handling of Title I in New York. "The Battle of the Tavern on the Green has already had a salutary effect on the city," the Post commented. "Men have begun to feel that it is safe to question Robert Moses." Moses had been receiving daily reports of the controversy in Spain. Returning, the circles under his eyes bigger and darker than when he had left 3 weeks before, he tried to smile for the photographers who had boarded a pilot's boat and crowded onto the Cristoforo Colombo as it was still steaming up the harbor toward its berth, posing him at the rail of the big liner. But the pictures showed a smile so forced that it was more of a grimace. 24 days alone with the wife whose advice had helped him out of tight spots before had had some effect. He made an obvious effort to contain himself, greeting reporters genially and telling them, "I don't intend to get excited about this matter. There is an enormous acreage in Central Park, and this discussion is all over one half an acre and the taking down of four sick trees." When reporters asked him about the price of a steak at the tavern, he said, "I don't know anything about the price of steaks at the tavern," and, still containing himself, added, "I'm not going to let them get my goat or get disturbed about it. I have other things to do. I don't propose to get excited about it. I know something about New York and its people, and I'm sure they all appreciate what we have done in the city." Turning to the skyline the liner was moving past, he said, the face creaking into a smile again, "Isn't this a wonderful city?" But the questions continued, questions of the kind that no reporter had asked Robert Moses since the gubernatorial campaign of 1934. And the outcome now was the same as the outcome then. For 24 days, bile had been rising in his gorge. Now, in a rush, it spilled over. "Oh, who are these critics, anyway?" he demanded. "Troublemakers. A small, noisy minority. You have Mr. Isaacs and the Citizens Union and these childless women howling about their non-existent children. Take a woman like Fanny Hurst. Where are all her children? I've never heard of her having any children." He had been making similar attacks for years, but never had they been handled as these were handled. Not only the Post, it had not previously occurred to most Americans that they had to give birth before disputing Robert Moses. But other newspapers treated his words as the outburst of a cranky old man, almost as a joke not worth taking seriously. His victims even got what so many past victims had been denied, a chance to reply. Watching Moses on television, the Newmans suffered over the insult to the elderly woman they had persuaded to join the fight. "I don't know how Fanny Hurst took it, but I took it very badly," Augusta Newman would say. Perhaps she had always wanted children and couldn't have any. When reporters called for comments, Arnold Newman called Moses' statement a proper greeting from a man with a concrete mind and a non-existent heart. And his wife invited the park commissioner up to visit my non-existent children, aged 4 and 6. And these rebuttals were played high, as was the fact that the request for an injunction had been brought in the name of Mrs. Norma Rosen, mother of two. On reaching his office that afternoon, moreover, Moses must have known that worse was to come. Waiting on his desk was a copy of a memo from Brown to Wagner summarizing a private conference the Corporation Council had held with Field. According to the memorandum, at that conference, the mother's attorney had noted that he had not yet revealed in court many of Moses' more damaging statements made under oath in the casino case or the full details of Moses' arrangements with many park concessionaires. In the event of a trial, Field had said, he would be compelled to amend his complaint to raise these issues and to present data that would undoubtedly tend to perpetuate the publicity received in the press and might prompt challenge to other activities of Commissioner Moses. Moses knew what his statements and those arguments were. For one thing, he had authorized Schleifer to spend $48,000 for a separate corridor for guests at plush private wedding parties. He must have known how his statements and arrangements would look in print. He did what he had never done, at least publicly, before. He backed down. Brown was anxious to drop the case. Moses in the dock, that would be the number one show in town no matter what else was playing, the Corporation Council would say years later. What was number one in 1956? My Fair Lady? My Fair Lady would be the number two ticket if Moses was in the dock, and he was going to look bad. Everybody loves moms. You can't beat that. I had great respect for him. The greatest respect for him and for his accomplishments. My regard for him was really without limits, and I didn't want to see that. To avoid that, Brown had worked out an arrangement under which Moses might save at least a little face, and by June 7th, he had privately obtained Field's consent to it. The city would use a series of delaying tactics to keep the case from coming to trial, without announcing that it was being dropped, which would have been a formal admission of defeat. Then, after a suitable period of delay, long enough, hopefully, for the furor to die down a bit, Moses would announce that he had decided to give the mothers the play space they wanted by building another playground on the site on which he had wanted to build the parking lot. This would enable Moses to avoid announcing that he was dropping the parking lot plan and simply leaving the park the way the mothers wanted it. And it would also enable him to avoid the charge that he had destroyed trees for no purpose at all. Field would be privately notified of what was going on so that he would not press the case. Walking over to Moses' office in the State Office Building at 270 Broadway, across City Hall Park from his own in the Municipal Building, Brown stopped by Wagner's for last-minute orders, but received only one. Keep him out of it. The mayor was almost frantically anxious to avoid any confrontation with his park commissioner. At 270 Broadway, Brown found that Wagner was not the only key figure in the dispute who wanted to keep involvement limited. Brown was accustomed to finding Moses surrounded by his retinue whenever he arrived at the coordinator's office. This time, when he was ushered in, Moses was alone. I just told him that a trial would be the kind of thing that wasn't going to do anyone any good, Brown recalls. And I said if you do this, build the playground, it will show you're even a bigger man than people know you are. Then, according to a memo Brown sent Wagner the next day, Commissioner Moses agreed that if the litigation should continue, a trial would be held and unfavorable publicity would result. Commissioner Moses was agreeable to an adjournment to avoid an early trial, with the possibility of ultimately disposing of the case without further litigation. Attempting to save face, Moses allowed no hint that the case was being dropped to sneak into the press. Instead, the Corporation Counsel's office kept requesting delays, none of which Field objected to. Then, 6 weeks later, on July 17th, after an unannounced meeting in which Brown signed on behalf of the city a stipulation that the city would build the playground, and Field signed one that in that event the suit would be dropped, Moses' aides distributed a press release announcing that he had decided to build a playground rather than a parking lot. The Tavern on the Green fight, the Battle of Central Park, was over. The man who never retreated had retreated at last. But he had not retreated in time. The amount of face saved was infinitesimal. The press treated his announcement as the barely conditional surrender it was. Moses surrenders to Mothers. Moses loses his park battle. Moses yields. Mothers win. Over a post-editorial, one for our side. The aura of invincibility, the aura that had been so important to him in the past, the aura that had lasted for 30 years, was gone, destroyed in a day just as the aura of infallibility had been destroyed. And this was the least of what the Battle of Central Park cost Robert Moses. He had allowed himself to remain too long in the glare of a spotlight strong enough to show him as he was. The city had finally gotten a good look at the man behind the legend. Part of the legend still remained unilluminated. Even after the battle, Robert Moses was still, in the public consciousness, a man uninterested in money, a man who ignored bureaucrats and politicians, who was above political considerations. He was still the man who got things done. Those elements of the Moses myth remained untouched. But other elements had been destroyed. No one who had followed the battle closely could believe any longer that Robert Moses was in public life solely to serve the public. It had been all too obvious that what he wanted was to be not the public servant, but its master, to be able to impose his will on it. That was one crack in the image. There were others. Moses' public appeal had always been based largely on his identification with the magic word parks. In the public mind, he had always, first and foremost, been the Robert Moses of Sunken Meadow and Jones Beach, the fighter for and defender of open space and grass and trees and sun and surf and brine for urban masses. The halo placed on his head by the Timber Point fight 30 years before had now been knocked off. He was, moreover, identified by the Tavern on the Green fight with the bulldozer. By the mid-1950s, the bulldozer had quite specific connotations in the public mind. Now the name of Moses had those connotations too. The aura of infallibility was gone also. If Moses was the man who got things done, implicit was the assumption that the things that he got done were things that should be gotten done. He had always been portrayed as a man who was right. Now, in a single dramatic tableau, he had been shown to be utterly, unmistakably wrong. Most important, the aura of incorruptibility was gone. It was gone unfairly, for nothing he had done for the Tavern on the Green was illegal, and by the standards by which the public judges morality in politics, what he had done for the restaurant was only faintly immoral. But it was gone nonetheless. The breath of scandal had tarnished this incorruptible public figure only slightly, but slightly was enough. His image had once dazzled even most of the reporters and editors hardest to dazzle. Now, it no longer shone quite so brightly. The press could look at Robert Moses and at his operations and methods as they would look at the operations and methods of an ordinary public official. And they looked. "That Tavern on the Green thing, that was such an insignificant thing," Sid Shapiro would say, years later, looking back on his idol's career. "It was such a meaningless little thing. I don't know to this day what the hell those people got so excited about, but it was, I don't know, it was just never the same after that." Chapter 43. Late Arrival. The great statesman McKee is a synthetic character which never actually existed on sea or land, puffed up by the press, and now in the process of deflation. There is a large amount of unfairness to the individual in this process, but in the end, it arrives at the truth. Robert Moses, 1933. At about the time that the Battle of Central Park was ending, investigative reporter Gene Gleason of the World Telegram and Sun was winding up his latest assignment. His editors, trying to think up a new one, asked him if he had anything in mind. Yes, he said, he had. Robert Moses. The Tavern on the Green concession contract spelled immense profits for someone, Gleason explained. And that was just one contract. Moses, in his many different governmental roles, was the author of scores, hundreds probably, of contracts. World Telegram rewrite man Fred J. Cook recalls the reporter saying, "This is the most powerful SOB in the city. If this is so bad at the tip of the iceberg, there must be more." The World Telegram was not one of the New York dailies aggressively dedicated, from the publisher's office on down, to the idealization of the coordinator. Moses' relationship with publisher Roy W. Howard was more cordial than close. His overwhelmingly favorable coverage in Howard's newspaper was more a function of his secret, favor-cemented relationship with the paper's veteran chief political reporter, Murray Davis. Still, because of the image of Moses the Incorruptible, prior to the Battle of Central Park, Gleason would have been told to go hunt up another idea. Now, city editor Norton Mockridge told him to go ahead and asked him in what field of Moses' far-flung operations he would like to begin looking. A number of considerations motivated Gleason's reply. He would have liked to begin with the power of the public authorities, but, Cook recalls, it was recognized that that would be a terribly tough nut to crack, both because no one had done any groundwork on the authorities' place in government and society on which a reporter could draw, and because the records were super secret, and the ultimate documentation necessary for exposés, the records that confirm an investigator's hunches in black and white, would therefore be unattainable. Some groundwork had been done on Moses' Title I Slum Clearance Committee, however. Gleason's interest had been piqued some months before by a series on Manhattan Town by the Post's Joe Kahn, who, happening to pass the renewal site, had seen in the middle of it a large parking lot, had begun wondering, why should they have a parking lot if they were going to build housing, had dug out the clips on the 1954 Senate Caspert hearings, and had written a series pointing up the fact that almost 2 years after those hearings, and more than 4 years after Moses had turned over the site to Caspert's reliable developers, who had been milking it ever since, the only development was the parking lot. Reading the 2-year-old transcript of the Senate hearings, the hearings all but ignored by the New York press, Gleason realized, as Cook put it, that it had the makings of a scandal. It was obvious. The investigator told Mockridge that he wanted to look into Title I. His first look was not particularly searching or perceptive. He uncovered few facts not already in print somewhere else, in con series or in individual human interest features on the eviction of some impoverished tenant, in one-shot articles on the protests of the residents of Moses' threatened neighborhoods, in the relocation studies made by the Women's City Club and Lawrence Orton's Undercover City Planning Commission unit. But new facts were not necessary. Plenty to document the true shape of the Moses version of urban renewal were already available, had been available for years, in hearing transcripts or in club or commission pamphlets, rich nuggets of news just lying around waiting for someone to pick them up, put them together, show them not as isolated incidents but as part of a pattern, and print them. And on July 30, 1956, just a month after the conclusion of the Battle of Central Park, the World Telegram and Sun began printing them. For all its omissions, the first series on Title I, researched by Gene Gleason and written by Fred J. Cook, painted a disturbing picture of the way New York City was being reshaped. It showed, as no one had previously shown, the relationship between the fact, previously written about in any real depth only by Kahn, that on many Title I sites no development had taken place in the 4 years since the city had handed them over to private interests, and the fact, brought out in the Caspert hearings but never before documented in all its shocking details by anyone, that Moses' system financially encouraged failure to develop. It showed that the slum clearance program was clearing not just slums, but healthy, pleasant residential and business sections, and was not building anything to replace them. If it did not contain the real dynamite that a little digging would have uncovered, the fact that Robert Moses, the man who allegedly refused to deal with politicians, had turned over a $1 billion program to shady politicians, it contained ample documentation of Cook's disturbing conclusion. It is a system under which neighborhoods actually have deteriorated. It is a system under which the number of apartments, already inadequate, has been reduced for years to come. It is a system beginning again the cycle of overcrowding and bad housing that creates slums. Most importantly, while previous media coverage had almost invariably referred to Title I as the city's program, Cook made sure that readers understood it was the city's Slum Clearance Committee, Robert Moses chairman. If Gleason and Cook did not disclose, because they did not understand, that Moses was not only the official in charge of Title I, but the official in sole charge, that neither mayor nor any other elected official of the city but he and he alone made all final decisions in regard to this program that was supposed to reshape the city, they nonetheless nailed the responsibility for Title I's failures to his door more firmly than it had ever been nailed before. Moses' name may still have not been in headlines about the failures, but at least, at last, it was in print. If the editors of the World Telegram and Sun realized the significance of the series, they concealed that realization well. Only one of its parts even made page one, and there were other indications that while the Moses image may have been tarnished, it still retained enough glitter to intimidate, that the editors were regretting having given Gleason the go-ahead on Robert Moses, that, having taken the plunge at last, they were trying to make an about-face in mid-air. Apprising Moses of the series contents in advance, they gave the coordinator space each day to attack, in a separate article, their own newspaper's stories. Moses' name was, moreover, conspicuous by its absence from the headlines over the Gleason-Cook revelations of faults in his program. It appeared only in the headlines over his own articles praising that program. Not only did the Telly's editorial writers not praise the series, they didn't even mention it. But still, the most significant fact about the series was that it ran at all. Investigative reporters quickly become aware of a phenomenon of their profession. Information so hard to come by when they are preparing to write their first story in a new field suddenly becomes plentiful as soon as that first story has appeared in print. Every city agency has its malcontents and its idealists and its malcontent idealists. Officials and aides and clerks and secretaries unhappy with the philosophy by which it is being run or the payoffs that are being made within it, who have been just waiting for years for the appearance of some forum in which their feelings can be expressed. When they realize that there is one at last, when they see that first story, they cannot get their information to its writer fast enough. Scores of city employees, men and women angry for personal or philosophical reasons at the inside workings of the Moses Empire, and hundreds if not thousands of city residents whose homes or neighborhoods had been destroyed for his Title I projects, and who then had watched vainly for years for the projects to be built, had been looking for such a forum. They had been desperate for one. They had almost given up their hopes of finding one. With the exception of the Post, they had never had one, and the Post had exposed his philosophy rather than his payoffs, the scandals on which so many officials and residents were convinced they had information. Now, with the appearance of the first Gleason-Cook series, these people were convinced that at last such a forum had appeared, and the two journalists' telephones began humming with calls. Some anonymous, some not, some from private individuals, many from officials up to and including a liberal Bronx congressman, revealing the secrets of the Moses operation, the politicians who were the real interests behind his frontmen developers, the deals that had been made with city agencies to immunize those developers from health laws, Along with the calls came letters. Out of one envelope fell a clipped-out newspaper ad for Pratt Institute Housing in Brooklyn, with a name circled, Rental Agent Samuel Caspert. As soon as Gleason picked up the clipping, he realized what its sender was trying to tell him. Manhattan Town was not the only development that Moses had turned over to that phony developer. On the day the series ended, Cook summarized future leads that should be dug into. Mockridge, passing the rewrite man's memo along to managing editor Richard Starnes, scribbled on it, R.S., seems we've got some material for more stories. Shall we go ahead? R.S. said yes, and Gleason was soon holding conferences with city officials. With virtually only one exception, Hortense Gable, even the most cooperative of these officials were wary of Moses' power. All interviews had to be completely off the record, of course. Gleason could not find a single official willing to be quoted. Because most were afraid to have the reporter seen in their offices, and many, believing their phones were tapped, refused to talk to him over the telephone, Gleason met them, after dark, in their automobiles or in out-of-the-way bars. One was so terrified that a key memo might find its way into print and thereby reveal his cooperation that he read the document to the reporter, but refused to let him touch it. Without access to the records of the Slum Clearance Committee, information about the involvement of key politicians could not be documented, and therefore could not be printed. But there was plenty of other material that could be checked out. Finding that the newspaper clipping tip on Pratt checked out, Gleason reported on August 28, 1956, that the key figures in that operation were also Caspert and Company, and that instead of developing the site, they were milking it as they had Manhattan Town. Returning to the bombed-out Brooklyn neighborhood in January 1957, Gleason came back with notes from which Cook wrote a story about a 92-year-old woman huddling in blankets and an overcoat in an apartment in which a thermometer registered 40.5 degrees, and about a mother who hadn't been able to give her two little boys a bath all winter because there hadn't been any hot water, about complaints being ignored not only by the developers, but by the city health department. We have yet to see an inspector around here. Some of the anonymous phone calls were coming from an aide in the city comptroller's office. In April, one call from this source informed Gleason that the Pratt developers weren't paying their real estate taxes to the city, hadn't been for almost 3 years, and, now that they had milked the project for millions, were planning to pull out and turn it back to the city. When Gleason ran this story, he had to include in it denials by Spargo and Liebal, speaking for Moses, but it was soon confirmed by an announcement from the developers. Then Gleason's informant told him that other Title I developers were also not paying taxes. Presenting himself in the comptroller's office, Gleason demanded to see the tax records, and on April 24, 1957, working from Gleason's notes, Cook revealed that while developers had reaped fortunes from Title I projects, the city is holding the bag to the tune of nearly $1 million in delinquent taxes and interest. The play of these stories was still not big. To Gleason's and Cook's disgust, the articles on Pratt ran only in the Brooklyn edition. And a giant must still be treated as a giant. There had been headlines for almost a year now when the World Telegram on Title I exposés, but Moses' name was seldom in those headlines. His name was seldom in the stories, in fact, partly because of his success in letting Spargo, Liebal, and Brooks speak for him. It was not until the 14th paragraph of the April 24th revelations on the tax delinquencies of the developers selected by the Slum Clearance Committee that the name of the chairman of that committee was mentioned. The city's other dailies were in general picking up the Gleason-Cook stories only to allow Wagner to deny them, the mayor soothingly reassuring the public that everything was going along fine in Title I. Even in the Post, Title I revelations were few and far between. And as for the Times, bellwether and fashion setter for the city's press, in January 1957, the day after Gleason had revealed that tenants on the Pratt site were freezing in their apartments and that the health department was doing nothing about it because of a secret agreement with the Slum Clearance Committee, the Times, practically apologizing for running the story at all, it became an issue yesterday because of allegations in a newspaper, stated straight-facedly that the Department of Health reported yesterday that tenants awaiting relocation from slum clearance sites had been getting more heat and better sanitary services as a result of its crackdown on five developers, and repeated without qualification the following lie. Robert Moses, chairman of the Slum Clearance Committee, said his agency, which is in charge of Title I development, had made no deal with the health department. He said he had told all developers they must obey all city regulations. The Times did, on May 26th, run one long story on Title I. The headline read, City Leads Nation in Slum Clearing. Then there ensued a development more difficult for editors to play small. In June, Moses was informed by Spargo and Liebwahl that Manhattan Town Inc., whose tax arrears had now topped $600,000 and were rising every day, had, because its officers had been siphoning out the money as fast as it came in, none available to pay the taxes any time in the foreseeable future, that there was also no money in sight to pay the interest on the $2 million mortgage Moses had persuaded the city to give them, let alone the amortization, that there was no money in sight to build any of the buildings the corporation had, more than 5 years before, contracted to build on the six-block site Moses had turned over to it, that, in short, there was no possibility at all that his reliable bidders could go ahead with the project. Moses had no choice. On June 11th, the Slum Clearance Committee asked the Board of Estimate to institute foreclosure proceedings and take back the property in the name of the city so that it could be turned over to a new sponsor. The move was made, through Corporation Counsel Peter Campbell Brown's office, as quietly as possible. The Times' initial play of the story was not designed to make any noise either. The revelation that a corporation to which the city had turned over 338 buildings worth $15 million for only $1 million, a corporation which didn't even bother to pay its city taxes, a corporation which had for 5 years been collecting rents on those buildings, was now saying that it could not develop the site after all, was found worthy by the Times editors of five paragraphs on page 14. But the rest of the press was less discreet. Every charge Gleason and Cook had been making for so many months had turned out to be true, and most newspapers played it that way. As Cook was later to write, the scandal that Moses and Wagner had kept denying for a year was there at last for everyone to see, confirmed in eight-column headlines. Gleason was even allowed a very personal moment of triumph. For months, he had been trying in vain to obtain an interview with Wagner. Now Wagner had no choice but to hold a press conference on Title I, and Jean Gleason was there. Every time the mayor attempted to excuse the fiasco by blaming it all on the promoters, saying they had misled the city, Gleason would remind him that the facts had been in print, over and over again, for almost a full year. As Cook put it, it had all been there in black and white for city officials to read, and they had done nothing except to deride the revelations. How did the mayor explain that? In the climactic moment, "We were misled," Mayor Wagner confessed, unhappily. "You mean to say you were conned for 5 years?" Gleason asked. "Well, if you want to put it that way, yes. I guess you could say we were conned for 5 years," the mayor acknowledged. For a few days, the press focused on Title I. Even the Times moved the story onto its front page, although in no newspaper was Moses linked directly and repeatedly with the scandal being unfolded. The Times article announcing that new sponsors were replacing the original reliable bidders of 5 years before on several Title I projects said, "The changing ownership is regarded in building circles as the squeezing out from the slum clearance program of some of the early promoters who had little construction know-how." Neither the Times nor any other paper asked why these promoters had been allowed into the program in the first place, or who had allowed them in. Nonetheless, Gleason and Cook were confident that there would be at least curtailment of Moses' powers and quite possibly the mayor's acceptance of the resignation that Moses was continually offering him. Deep as they had probed into corruption in city government, they had not probed deep enough. They still did not understand the fundamental reality of Moses' relations with that government and the venal machine of which that government was in crucial respects no more than an extension. They did not understand the extent to which the machine depended on Robert Moses, the extent to which he was its feeder, the supplier of the raw meat of patronage and contracts, of premiums and fees, of the whole stew of honest graft on which it battened. They did not understand that he was the only feeder possessed of enough food to satisfy its ravenous appetite. They did not understand that the machine needed Robert Moses, needed him at least as much as he needed it, that the county organizations of which the borough presidents, and in 1957 the mayor, were only representatives, could not do without him. The two reporters' expectation was not unreasonable. Ordinarily, the tainting of a city program with scandal and failure, scandal of immense proportions, failure 5 years in duration, would result in at least curtailment of the powers of the mayoral subordinate heading that program, lest the public outcry turn against the mayor. Their expectation was just based on a false premise, that Robert Moses was really the mayor's subordinate. They did not understand that, as a matter of practical politics, the mayor could not discipline, demote, or remove Title I's administrator. And so they were surprised at ensuing developments. Moses, or rather Moses' spokesman, Spargo, Liebwohl, and Brooks, the coordinator was keeping his lowest profile ever, announced that a new sponsor, William Zeckendorf's Webb & Knapp, Inc., was willing to take over all Manhattan Town's debts, including its liabilities to the city, and build the project. Gleason and Cook realized that by changing owners without foreclosing on the old ones first, Moses was allowing Manhattan Town, Inc. to escape from the project, which they had been milking for 5 years, with no financial penalties whatsoever. But the advantages for the city were undeniable, not only because of the avoidance of lengthy foreclosure proceedings, but because, in obtaining Zeckendorf, the city was trading in a promoter for a genuine developer. And letting Manhattan Town go scot-free was something that was only to be expected. Whatever the nature of the political muscle that had allowed the corporation to milk a sizable slum for 5 years while the city turned a blind eye to tax arrears, that muscle was certainly strong enough to keep the city from taking any genuine punitive action against it. But then some of the details of the takeover arrangement to which Moses had agreed, and on which he had apparently sold the mayor and the Board of Estimate, were leaked to light. Not by Moses' tight-sealed slum clearance committee, of course. As usual, that group deliberated in secret, but by City Hall. Under the arrangement, Webb and Knapp would not merely insure Manhattan Town's principals against any liability to the city. It would buy out the two principal stockholders, Seymour Milstein and Jack Furman, Caspert having prudently sold out before the company's collapse, for $533,250, and put them on Webb and Knapp's payroll as consultants for 5 years at a fee of $30,000 per year, a total of $150,000 more. These two men, key figures in Manhattan Town since its inception, were not merely being allowed, after 5 years of delay, 5 years during which they had made fortunes, to slip quietly into the night without punishment. They were being paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to do so. And this money was not for all their stock. Under the Moses-approved arrangements, Furman and Milstein would be given sizable stock holdings, between them a total of 32% in Webb and Knapp's Manhattan Town subsidiary. The developers who hadn't developed, Cook wrote, would be entitled in the future to nearly one-third of the profits of the developer who did develop. The cast of characters in the Manhattan story was, moreover, getting a significant addition. The Moses-approved contract did not, of course, contemplate any reduction in Democrat Samuel Rosenman's $250,000 retainer, but it added another $75,000 legal fee to Daniel J. Reisner, president of the National Republican Club. Outcry in the press, the afternoon press primarily, apparently panicked the administration.